Alive and Kicking
with Claire McKenna.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
This is News Talk.
Yes, this is Alive and Kicking, News Talk's health and wellness show. I'm Claire McKenna, and you can contact the show by emailing aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up on today's show, I meet Irish journalist Jennifer McShane, who wants to move to London, but a mild disability is causing havoc with her plans. Elite runner Anthony Doyle puts me through my paces to get me pink run ready. And eco-guilt, is climate change keeping you awake at night? So, what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, my good friend Georgie Crawford asked me recently if I'd come on her successful podcast, The Good Glow. Now, I was delighted because I am an avid listener to it every week. And last Sunday, it went out. And the reaction I've got has been amazing. Now, I'm not an expert on health and wellness, and I don't necessarily have an inspirational turnaround story that some of her previous guests have. But I just talked about myself and, you know, my health and wellness. And so many people have contacted me during the week to say it made them smile or they're going to drink a little bit more water. I mentioned I have an obsession with water. I, even as I speak, have a 2 litre here beside me. And it was just a good vibe thing. That's why I mention it. It was people I used to work with came out of the woodwork and said that they'd heard it. It's like when there's a family occasion, a wedding, a new baby, a celebration, when people just come together and get good vibes going. It was that on a social media scale, and I thought it was good for my health and wellness this week. And speaking of social media, in the news this week, Jameela Jamil, the UK TV presenter, now TV actress in the US, she's a longtime activist for body positivity, and I'd have to say I've been fairly conflicted in my support for her. She advocates for no airbrushing in photographs, and I've often thought to myself, well, it's easy for her to say she's absolutely gorgeous, but actually that shouldn't really diminish her argument, and I am in support of what she's doing. And this week she's had a victory in another of her long-standing campaigns to regulate the selling and promotion of weight loss products and procedures on social media. Instagram, which has over 1 billion users, will roll out a new policy focused on diet pills, weight loss teas, appetite suppressant lollipops, which would just blow your mind, really. From now on, any of those type of products that have a price tag attached, a direct ad for them, will only be viewable by those over the age of 18. And Instagram are also introducing a ban on any content that make miraculous claims. So any celebrity saying, I've sipped this tea and I've lost 10 pounds, that won't be allowed anymore. It will be removed because it'll be going against the rules. So I just think that's a really positive step in the right direction. You can contact the show by emailing aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. So Jennifer McShane is an Irish journalist who wants to make the move to the bright lights of London. But believe it or not, it's not Brexit that could stand in her way. It's the struggle she faces with people's reactions to her mild disability. Jennifer joins me in studio now. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, Claire. Thank you very much.
And even introducing you like that, I'm annoyed at myself for having to put mild disability into the first paragraph about you, because I just don't think it should be what defines you. I mean, I'm glad I got to put out your name and that you're a journalist, that ultimately you're just a person. But to raise awareness for the difficulties you faced in trying to move to London, it's worth us having this discussion.
For sure. And I think a lot of people feel that hesitance of kind of not using the label to say, well, she has a disability. And for years, I probably might have been like that myself. I might have been afraid, perhaps, that somebody would use that and that's all they'll see. But at the end of the day, I do have mild cerebral palsy. It is a partial disability, and it's the elephant in the room. Like, it's there. So I'm not offended by anyone using it. And if that's, you know, it's part of the discussion that we need to have. So you have to say, well, these are my difficulties, and it's because of the disability that it's happening. You don't have to let it define you. But I think if you're going to be at the stage where you get offended if people are using that, and, you know, if it's used in a primarily negative way, then understandably, but if they're just using it for the topic and it's part of who you are, then there shouldn't be that kind of, well, don't use it. Certainly not now in my 30s.
Yeah, no, there's no shame in it, and it's not a secret.
No.
But the fact that it comes up time and time again, it should just be a part of you that you can just move on with. But tell me a little bit about having mild cerebral palsy, what that is meant in your life, or what exactly that is.
So mild cerebral palsy, I'm lucky in that it is mild. There's different degrees of the mild cerebral palsy, and you have it from birth, so it's not hereditary or anything like that, which some people think it might be. So mine primarily affects my walking and my balance and my right side slightly. I was diagnosed around 18 months and I'm in my 30s now, so I've had it for quite a few years. And basically, obviously, I'm lucky in that it's not too severe and that I can still get around fairly independently. But if I were outside the studio now, I'd probably be in a K-walker, which is what I use if I'm outside or distances. So basically things like stairs, anything that might knock my balance off, even those escalators. Like that move underneath your feet, even like the unexpected noise from a car alarm. Like I know it sounds totally stupid, but something like that could knock my balance off. So it really means that I just have to be hyper aware of my surroundings and like the path on the pavement and anything that might trip me up. So if something does trip me up, I probably can't get up unaided. So that's why I'm extra conscious of when I'm out, what the ground is like, if it's accessible. And unfortunately in Dublin, not a lot of it is. So you have to just be aware. And also, even though I detest taking that K-walker out with me, it has to come because you have to put personal safety first. So it just means that my day-to-day is probably a bit more difficult. But again, this is what I know. So it's not too difficult in that it's always been that way. So you're just trying to work around what you have, I suppose, and make sure that you can still live as independently as possible. Not easy in Dublin because the public transport is not made for anyone that's not fully able-bodied, in my opinion. So my preferred method of commute is taxis, and it costs me a fortune.
I saw you put up on Twitter, over 560
Over 500
euro.
Is the average that I would have to spend getting around, because you can't rely on the buses. I don't live near enough to a Lewis or anything like that. So, you know, if it comes between getting three buses or getting one taxi, what are you going to do?
And why? Because you're not guaranteed that the bus that will come will be...
You're not guaranteed. And as well, like if it's in the winter and it's raining, and my immunity would be a lot lower. So you can't be standing out in the rain. And if I have a walker, I can't use an umbrella. So all practical things like that people might not realise are what you're up against. I'm looking that I can get up and get around. I mean, I've heard tales of people that use chairs been stranded on sides of platforms because lifts don't work. But if I had a frame, I would be in that same situation. So if the lifts don't work, how do I get me and that up a set of stairs? You can't. But the way you kind of have to deal with it is you don't think about it too much. You kind of just take it day by day, because if you thought about everything that could potentially go wrong when you leave the house, you probably never would.
I know. And I mean, not only are you leaving the house, but you're looking to leave the country as a journalist. Obviously, London, the bright lights shine very bright. And just, you know, it's a very attractive place live, Brexit aside.
Yeah. No, I've always loved London. It's busy and it's exciting. And apart from anything else, their public transport is really, really good. Like I was back and forth recently for a few interviews and that, and I could just get around. The overground, it's amazing. Once you know that it's step free, there's an app that tells you what's step free and what's not. So I could just get around for the entire day, leave my frame, not have to fold it up, get on and off. It was totally seamless. And that's the thing that I strive for when I'm out and about and on my day-to-day life is, you know, seamless. I want it to be as easy as possible. I don't want to have to fold up the frame and then get it up again and then get into a cab and then have to get a Lewis. I want to be able to go from A to B in the frame and stay in the frame and have that kind of fluidity. But it's not possible, unfortunately, in Dublin. So when I was looking at places to go, that was a huge factor for me. And the fact that there's, you know, it's very busy and exciting and there's, you know, a lot of work there and things like that. Even with Brexit, it still holds an appeal for me in that way.
Absolutely. So it's something I wish I had have done at some point. But you have also come up against a hurdle when it comes to finding somewhere to live.
Yes. So this was something that I thought about but then didn't, because I think, oh yeah, it'll be fine in my own bubble thinking that. But when I started to do the search, and I have a couple of requirements, so that can't be higher than first floor, because, you know, I can get upstairs, but if there's an emergency in the middle of the night, how are you going to get down them and that kind of thing. So it has to be ground floor or first floor max, ideally ground floor, because I have to have the frame. So if I can't lift that up a flight of stairs, it has to be left downstairs, and what if somebody takes it? And then there's the shower. So most places that I have seen within budget are over a bath, because they're quite old buildings. So that's not a possibility either. It must be a shower. So even those two things alone, and staying in an area that's safe because I'm going on my own, that's close enough to accessible transport, it proved to be a massive challenge. Like, there just seemed to be anything that the average budget seems to be about £1,500, but that's excluding bills. So that's not within my budget at the moment. So you have to think, well, how can I do that? And it means going further out, but it also means going to a part of the country that maybe doesn't have an overground. And then you're stuck on buses for, what, 2 hours each way? So that's not ideal either. So which is various things like that. But even the practicalities of trying to find a ground floor. And the theory goes, oh, not everybody, no one wants ground floor. But I was like, well, they must, because there's none available. And then you have the issue of, well, OK, so how, if I was sitting here talking to you, you wouldn't know that anything was different. So how do I explain that to an agent without making it feel, making them feel that it's a massive hurdle? Because that's how I feel in my head. It's that I have to kind of downplay it as much as possible so that no one thinks it's so big a deal that they won't want to rent to me. Because I've heard some stories as well about that.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't have to feel like you could be a liability to someone. You're just looking for somewhere to live.
Stay. Yeah, and they can't now, legally they can't, because I was onto a very nice property company in London, the Branch Properties. They deal with accessibility and finding places. So legally, tenants cannot ask those questions. They can't.
Landlords can't mention.
No, they can't. And like, you can say it voluntarily, but they can't use that technically as an excuse not to rent. Now, we all know that it still happens, but I have to tell, like, I was trying to go around initially to go back a step and just get a roommate. But then it was the same. It was like, oh, so you use a frame. And I had one person that repeated that sentence about 5 times. And if they say, well, you know, it's lower ground, it's the stairs, but there's no rail. And if you inquire about putting a rail in, then it's like, well, we found somebody else. So no one is saying it, but they're all kind of little things that are there and that you know that it's probably what it means. So I moved on to a property agent just to do it by the book. But then I still had the same thing. So I have to tell them, you know, they're saying, well, is it, you know, a deal breaker if there's no bath? Because that'll make it hard. If there's a bath, because it'll make it harder. Then I was like, yes, it's a deal breaker. There can't be a bath. And they're like, well, why? So I'm trying to explain, look, my mobility is reduced, but it's fine, you know.
Yeah.
And you're still trying to, it's a habit of mine to be like, it's fine, you know what I mean, to downplay it. And you shouldn't have to. You should be able to say, these are the difficulties that I have. Can you accommodate them? But for some reason, I always feel a block.
But with modern buildings, so I've certainly noticed it with houses now, just being the age that I am, I have, you know, bought a house myself, mm-hmm. or I have friends who have, and you see the modern builds all have a large downstairs toilet, all have larger door frames, that we're thinking about accessibility a lot more, but not enough, you're finding? Or is it that you're dealing with older buildings in London?
I think it's not enough. I think it's starting now. So any new builds have to have that quota where they have to have a lift and that. But I think that's rare enough. Like, a lot of, especially when you're talking about budget, I think it's fine if you have, you know, if you've 2K a month to spend just on your rent. I think you'll find anywhere, certainly in London, with your own concierge and your own lift. But
what jobs pay for that? Yeah. I want to work there.
Yeah, but anything I found that's kind of in the middle, certainly the buildings, because a lot of them have been converted.
Yeah, they're flats.
They're flats or old Victorian buildings. Like, for example, that's what took Kensington out of my search, because it's a beautiful place, but they're all old Victorian buildings. So that means you would generally always have to get upstairs to get to them. So things like that you wouldn't have even considered, and I wouldn't have considered before the search. You think, okay, well, that's out. Like, for example, East London is great because they have the DLR, but it's a business district and people are like, it's great, but there's nothing there after 5 p.m. So if you're on your own, like, so you're always kind of have to weigh it up. You're going to have to compromise somewhere.
But you're not giving up. You're saying you've kind of, you know, stood back, taken stock, and you're going at it again.
Yeah, I mean, I am. I mean, it can't be that difficult. You know, I mean, I think what I just underestimated at first is that there has to be, you need more time. Everything in my life with the cerebral palsy means things take longer. I always get there, but they'll take a bit longer. And that's the same with any search. If you're thinking about anybody looking for property in London that doesn't have any requirements, it's going to be difficult. So you have to know that it's probably going to take longer. But if I don't get it again when I go over next month, I'll go again. Do you know what I mean? I will keep going until I get something. It, you know, it can. And I think the biggest hurdle is your own mindset. If you think it's going to be difficult or you think it's going to be impossible, that's kind of, that attitude is going to stand to you and you're going to feel that there's always going to be something coming up against you. So you have to just be as positive as you can, even when it's the most difficult. So I'm confident they will find somewhere. And ironically, since the article's come out, I found letting agents to be a lot more receptive.
Well, Jennifer, I wish you all the best. It doesn't sound like you're going to let anything stand in your way. And I hope that you have your first Christmas. I'm sure you'll come home to your family for the day itself. Yeah. But your first Christmas tree in a beautiful ground floor apartment with a cool wet room. That just, there isn't a problem.
No,
I mean, they're all in, for God's sake. Yeah. Does anyone watch Room to Improve over there?
That's it. Well, thank you very much.
I really appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much. Coming up after the break, with a month to go to the Great Pink Run, in which I am undertaking 10K, I went out with an elite runner to get some top tips.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at repromed.ie.
So with the month to go to the Great Pink Run, I'm undertaking 10K on behalf of News Talk, all to raise much needed funds for Breast Cancer Ireland. But I wanted to get some advice while I'm out pounding the pavements. For anybody, really, you don't have to be taking part in anything. Even if you are a wannabe runner, I think you'll get something from my next guest. I went out, donned the runners, with an elite runner, Anthony Doyle of Anthony Doyle Fitness. Now, he has a marathon PB of 2 hours and 48 minutes. And that's fairly fast. So I started off by asking him about that.
That was actually weird how that happened. I never planned on running that time, Claire. That was my third marathon in 7 weeks. And it happened to be the Dublin Marathon in 2017. And my baby son, Hugo, was only born 2 weeks beforehand. And the night before the Dublin Marathon, I sort of threw the towel in because I was like so tired. And Sarah woke me up. She needed a hand. We were having a bit of a bad night. And we were on the way in, and I just threw everything out the window. I had no expectations about the marathon. I was just going to go out and do it. And as it happened, relieving the pressure from running the marathon, I ended up going running an 8-minute PB from 2:56 to 2:48. So I suppose what I could take from that is, and anybody else going running, is just go in with no real expectations of yourself. You know, you have to train and done, but just take the pressure off yourself and alleviate that as soon as you can, as quick as possible. And, you know, you probably will run better.
That's amazing. And then your baby son was also a good luck charm, I'd say.
He was definitely a good luck charm. And we had a lot of good luck over the next 6 months after that. He was born the day the Dubs won the All-Ireland in 2017. And then he got christened the day Ireland won the Grand Slam.
Good stuff. Well, they're still winning. And hopefully we'll continue the same in Japan. So keep us going, Hugo. How many marathons have you run at this stage? You're trying to tick a few off the list.
Yeah, so my goal is the 6 world major marathons in 6 years. So I have Berlin now, at the end of this next week, on the 29th of September, and that'll be the 5th from 6. And I aim to do 3 a year. Berlin will be 17 in total, and Dublin will finish off the year 4 weeks later, 18 this year.
Did you always love running, or did you acquire a love for running? Because that's something that runs through my head so much. Are there some people that are just designed for it, built for it, better at it, or do you just need to do it more often to get to that point?
Yeah, I think I don't think I acquired it. I remember my eldest sister, when she first met her partner, and he was involved in mixed martial arts, and he used to be going out training, and he used to bring me out running with him. And he'd always push me ahead of him. He'd never sort of let me run behind him. He'd always, I can stay in front of me, Anthony, stay in front of me. And I think from there then, I was like, oh, do you know what? I actually like this running. And I think it was 9 or 10 at the time. And then that year, I went and ran the cross-country championships for the school in Inchicore. And I ended up winning with a partner. It was a team event. And two of us won the national cross-country championships. And then from there with the football, then we were doing laps of pre-season or whatever, and I was always sort of lapping the lads and stuff like that. So I think I naturally had the ability of running, and it was only in 2011 that I ran my first marathon. So I think it was always there, but I didn't know it.
So let's bring it back to us mere mortals then, who are just trying to get out for a bit of running, because it is so popular now. I mean, it's free compared to a big gym membership, and it's getting you out, it's getting you in the fresh air, and it's getting you exercising, and it's kind of getting you over that hump of doing something you think you can't do. Couch to 5K is as much as any marathon to some people.
Absolutely. The Couch to 5K is actually some people's marathons. And you know what the best thing about running is? It's so accessible. It's so easy. Stick on a pair of runners, out you go. You don't need to be paying your big gym fees. And it's the most simplest sport in the world. It's basically putting one foot in front of the other. And to go faster, just do it quicker.
So let's talk about the runners then. Do you need to go and get all of the gear? Because quite often I'm guilty of that, going out and spending all the money when really you just need to get out the door. But how important are a decent pair of runners?
Yeah, no, look, come here. Look, looking parts half the battle is what some people say, but you know, it's good to invest in the runners. Forget about the trousers and the top, whatever it may be. Get a decent pair of runners. Like, stay away from your Converse or your cheap 5, 6 euro, 10 euro runners and pennies. They're not going to do it. They're going to probably cost you more harm than what it's worth. So invest like 30, 40, 50 euro in a pair of runners. Don't go off paying anything over 100 euro for a pair of runners. Unless you feel like, right, you're getting really into this, I actually am going to make a good investment.
Okay, good stuff. So what about then when you get out for the run? How important is it to stretch beforehand, and what stretches should you do?
Yeah, the research is there for running that, like, stretching before a run is not overly important, okay? So start off nice and easy. Let the body warm up as you're getting into your run. You might even start off, if you're doing your case 5K, a brisk walk. You know, use lampposts. If you're out on the coast, jog 3 lampposts, walk 1, or switch that around, and just gradually decrease the amount of lampposts that you're walking for and increase the amount that you're jogging for. Start off nice, easy pace, and the most important thing to do is, a lot of people are getting caught up with times. Even they haven't even started really running, and they're like, "Oh, what did that take?" The most important thing is to enjoy it. Enjoy your running.
Okay, well, I don't know if that's doable first time out. Let's start that bit of a warm up then while we're going. Before you even get out, what's the best thing to eat before a run, and like how long of an interval beforehand?
Well, look, it all depends on what you're doing. Like, if you're going for a marathon, you're going to be carb loading all week. So let's put that aside. You're not going to be doing that mostly. If you're going out for a 5K, a banana will do the job. You get your metabolism going, you have the energy to, lots of potassium in the banana. So, I mean, that'll be enough to get you through a 5K.
You don't want to be too full either.
No, so you don't need the big bowl of porridge or the big bowl of Weetabix or whatever. Even, do you know what even is nice? A bagel with some peanut butter and jam. That's enough to get you going.
Leave a half an hour to kind of digest and off you go.
Yeah, everybody's different. Like, everybody's metabolism is different. So, like, if you feel like that it takes a little bit longer for you to digest your food, get it in a good 45 minutes to an hour before you get out running it.
And have we all gone a bit mad now? Do we need... Like, if you're doing a 10K, do you need to be taking those hydration gels? Are they literally for the marathon runners only?
Again, like, if somebody's going out to do a 10K in 40 minutes, they probably, their breakfast will stand to them. But again, everybody's different. Some take a lot of people, like, 10K is 10K, but it might take somebody an hour and a half to do it. So you might need a gel there as well, but it's not something I'd be recommending.
Okay, because it's quite synthetic, isn't it?
Yes, it can be. Yeah, like, I mean, I changed there a couple of years ago. I was taking gels and they were saying take one every 20 minutes. And I was like, oh my God, this is having an effect on my tummy. But if you do a little bit of research, you can get some there. A lot less sort of glucose in it, slow release. So you're looking for good ingredients in it and you're not having to take too many. Connecticut is what I use and I find them, they work well for me.
All right, so we're warmed up a little bit. So I'm going to run a little bit and you can have a look at my run and see if it's good. Because there is a style to it, isn't it? You're supposed to try and be, I don't know, what, light on your feet? Is it heel to toe? What are the actual tips for when you're running and how important is that?
Yeah, everybody comes to me and they say, oh, which way is it? Look, we all have our own technique. It's not something don't try to change people's technique too much. They all do their own thing. The most important thing is to stay relaxed. Keep the shoulders relaxed. Keep the hands nice and loose. Don't clench your fists. Get your breathing going. Don't overthink about your breathing. A lot of people say, how are you supposed to breathe when you're running? Naturally. Okay, your breathing's going to get a little heavier when your heart rate elevates, but you know, just in through your nose, out through your mouth, keep it relaxed.
All right, do you want to have a look?
Okay, nice easy jog. Just think about, so a couple of small little factors would be, as we're out jogging here, so I don't want to give you too much information, just relax in the shoulders and have a look at where your hands are. So visualize that belly button, don't let your hands cross the midsection of your body. And by doing that, you're keeping your elbows in close and you're preventing the over-rotation of your shoulder. So that will come into effect probably if you're doing more long distance running because you're using up unnecessary energy. So just relax in the shoulders and hands not crossing the midline of your body.
And am I supposed to be keeping my tummy tight and my back straight?
Yeah, so core in nice and tight. So with a better core, you're going to get better balance and you're going to feel stronger and more confident in yourself. What I'll also say is try and get out and run with friends. I know people are living busy lives and, you know, it's very hard to get your friends together to go for a run. But if you can get out with your friends, it makes it easier because you're not actually thinking about how you're feeling. No. Because when you're with your friends, you're out talking, you're catching up on what went on and over the last few days in your life and, you know, having a chat. So that can alleviate you thinking about how you're feeling and, you know, you're going to feel better about yourself if you're out running with people. That's what I find anyway.
Does it take more energy to talk and run? It certainly feels it now.
Yeah, it's always hard at the start of a run getting your heart rate up. But when you get to that nice, comfortable pace, when you're jogging, you want to be jogging at pace that you can hold a conversation.
Okay. And what about if you wear a Fitbit or any of those type of watches? should you be keeping an eye on your heart rate?
Again, you're getting a little bit more technical there and getting into it. But like, the good thing about Fitbits for me is if it gets you up and gets you moving to achieve your daily fitness goal of steps, happy days, the Fitbit is winning. But I don't think you need to get too caught up with where the heart rate should be at. Where's my threshold? It should be running in this bracket or that bracket. You know, go on feel at the start. Don't put yourself under unnecessary pressure.
All right, so this is something I've thought of a lot. The running on grass as opposed to running on the pavement. We have a choice here now.
Yeah.
Is one better than the other?
Well, that comes at different times of the season. So, like, now we're out today. It was raining this morning, so the grass is going to be a little bit softer. So, you know, you're probably going to get a little bit of feedback off the grass. So you're getting a little bit more of a bounce rather than pounding the concrete. But then in the summer, you know, if we're getting really good summers, you know, the grass can just be as hard as the concrete itself. What I would say is just have, again, it's like driving your car. Put a good pair of tires on your wheels. You know, it's better. Look after your body by getting a good pair of runners and getting a good bit of foam in between you and the pavement, because every time you do run and one foot lands on the ground, that's 5 to 7 times your body weight going through your Achilles and up through the body. So try and get some good protection in between you and the ground.
Okay, so we've done a good comfortable-ish 5K there.
Yeah.
And we're going to do some sprints now. What are the benefits of sprints?
For sprints is now you're getting your heart rate up. You're going to be working at a level that's not sustainable for a long period of time. So the good side of that would be is obviously you're getting your heart rate up. You're getting out of your threshold into the anaerobic territory that in turn, over a period of time, if you're consistent with your training, when you go out and run at your 5K pace or your 10K pace, you'll be able to run at a higher level of effort. And in turn, you're getting your times down if in your runs and you're going to be running faster.
So what do you advise people get to?
Well, I would start...
A hill or...?
If you're starting out, stay away from hills. You want to alleviate any type of injury at the start. So you want to build up a good base level of fitness, get your body used to running on the road, and just start off with strides. You know, use 4 lampposts as maybe. Do like run down 4 lampposts, give yourself a 30 second break, run back 4 lampposts, and do maybe a set of 6 to 8 repetitions after your main workout.
Okay, well, you're better at running and talking than I am, clearly. What about at the end of all this then? What kind of stretches are essential so you don't get injured?
Yeah, so the main, like if you think about, obviously we're using our legs, so you're getting into your hamstring stretch, you're getting into your pigeon stretch, that's lying down on the ground, trying to get into that tall plank position, bring your right or left foot underneath your body and sitting down into it, dropping the hips towards the floor. So you're getting a good glute and abductor stretches.
Okay, so if you're looking for that on YouTube or whatever, it's the pigeon stretch?
Pigeon stretch, yeah, pigeon stretch. Also your quad stretch, so you can lean up against the wall, just grab your right foot, bring your heel into your bum. After your workout, you want to be holding each post-workout stretch for about 25 to 30 seconds. So from pounding the roads, our muscles are a certain length before we start exercising. And from that pounding on the road, it's going to cause a lot of tension through the muscles. So you're trying to bring your muscles back to the pre-exercise length.
What about things then like supplements? I hear a lot about oiling our joints with glucosamine and all that sort of stuff. If you're going to be running regularly, do you need to think a bit differently about what you're eating or your joints in that way?
Yeah, you definitely do. In regards to supplements, I'm not so sure. I think what the best thing to do is to make your joints stronger and your tendons stronger is to actually, if you can do weights. So you can even do these at home or outside in the park after you run. You can do like your body weight lunges, your body weight squats. That's going to build up the strength in your muscles, in your tendons, and in turn, it's going to protect your joints. It's going to give you a lot more stability and control when you're running.
If you get pains in your knees after running, is that something that just goes away with time as your muscles get stronger?
Yeah, well, pains around the knees, I suppose. I think as we get older, we start to feel a little bit more pain as we get older. But there's a good little warm-up that you can do before you start running. It's actually get your feet together and get your upper body nice and tall. And if you can look down, get your knees out to in line with your toes and just make circles clockwise, 10 in one direction, 10 in the other. And by doing that, you're getting the synovial fluid going around the joints, and it's sort of a help getting that lubricant going, so it's going to alleviate and help keep any type of pay or stiffness that you're going to feel away.
It's also kind of funky, isn't it?
It's kind of funky. Yeah, I actually dance like this when I'm out with the one or two times of the year that I do get out.
Synovial fluid out on a Saturday night. And then what about complementary therapies, like getting a regular massage, seeing an osteopath to check your in alignment? I mean, I know we're not trying to promote that people go out and spend hundreds of euro on themselves unnecessarily, but do you need to keep an eye on your body and keep it in check?
No, you definitely need to look after your body, like 100%. But I don't, again, you said, I mean, a good pair of runners is all you need to run. You don't need to start putting in a lot of money in massage therapy, going to get your body this, that, and the other. I mean, your gait analysis is actually free. You can go into Lifestyle Sports, get your gait analysis. They'll tell you what type of runner that you need. I was actually talking to a really good physiotherapist last week, and she says, even the gait analysis, she doesn't really massively agree with it. She's like, get a pair of runners that's comfortable for you, and then you're winning.
Okay, so you're like an ambassador for the Pink Run, the Great Pink Run. You were doing a talk you mentioned there with the physiotherapist down in Kilkenny. So what, we've about a month to go. It's the 19th of October. Do people have enough time now to get themselves to 5K or 10K?
Absolutely. At the end of the day, we need to get this point across. It's not a run. You mean, you don't have to run it. You can walk it with your kids, your husband, the dog. You can jog it. You can walk a K. You can jog a K. Absolutely. I would say from the guys going from the 5K to the 10K, am I able to do the 10K 5 weeks out? I would say yes. You have a good base level down. But what I would say is week on week going forward, you're not going to run the 10K until the day of the run. But this weekend, you might do 6K, the following weekend, 7K, and add a K every weekend until you get to the Great Pink Run.
And before you know it, we'll be like you, and we'll be crossing world marathons off our list.
Everybody's just trying to be the best version of themselves, Claire. We all have individual goals.
Anthony Doyle, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Claire.
Coming up after the break, eco-guilt is now a thing. So how do you save the planet and your sanity? I'll be speaking to psychotherapist Helen Vaughan on that topic after the break.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at repromed.ie.
So therapists and psychologists are reporting a rise in eco-guilt, anxiety caused by climate change. So how can we save the planet and our sanity at the same time? Well, Helen Vaughan is a psychotherapist with Maynooth Counselling and she joins me in studio now. Hello, Helen.
Morning.
Now, you caught me answering a tweet about this. Sarah Breen, the co-author, I should say, of the Aisling books, she had said that she was feeling it and I identified with it and I didn't realise it was an actual thing until you made contact with me.
Well, it is a thing. And I have to say, in terms of sessions and clients, there's nobody has come to me yet with this as their main issue. But it has come up in sessions, but it's come up a lot with friends and I've seen it on social media and I have a few friends who've talked about it. And I have experienced it. You tweeted about your experience of it. You know, when I see someone using a coffee cup that's not a keep cup, it bothers me. And I just kind of want to say to them, would you not just get a keep cup? And I know they're a pain to carry around. But, you know, I have a toddler and I use cloth nappies. And one of my friends said, I've kind of turned into one of those Jesus-y preacher types that's gone too far maybe the other way. And I think that's the hard part about all of this, is that I think some of us get a bit too preachy about it and then other people get turned off. But I think a lot of people feel anxious that I'm not doing enough or I should do more or the world is going to end. And I think children, young people are really affected by it, which is fair enough because I think they're still innocent and kind of, I don't know, I feel like deep down I don't believe that the world is really going to end or explode or implode or whatever.
Now, some clever person is going to sort it all out, but it is seeping into our consciousness. And I think we do have to be aware, obviously, of climate change and what's happening and changes that we can make to our behaviour. But reading into it, it's the helplessness that some people feel, because you do hear crazy stuff like things aren't even being recycled, even though your stuff is being taken away, that you've meticulously washed out and dried and put in the correct bin, that it doesn't really make that much of a difference in the end.
No, and that's true. And I think it's terrible to point the finger at the media, but I think there are a lot of stories out there about kind of peddling this whole fear culture, you know, that everything we're doing is bad. You know, having children is bad. Flying is bad. Driving your car to work is bad. You should be on a bike. You know, and I think maybe some elements of the media are guilty of overhyping it to sell newspapers and make headlines and to get us to read things. Because you're like, oh, God, I'm not doing that. Should I be? You know, that there's this kind of fear culture, and I think we have to take a personal decision of whether we choose to read that article or click on that, whatever it is, or look at social media at 10 o'clock at night and start reading about, you know, the end of the world. When, you know, I think we have to make a personal decision to be like, I'm not, you know, you can block keywords on social media, for example, if you don't want to hear certain things. And it's not to say that you, not to be informed and to, you know, blinker yourself entirely to the whole issue. But it's about making a personal decision about when you read about it, what you read, what sources you're reading from. Are you reading some blog from someone who's a denier or who's a proponent of whatever kind of eco thing, you know? And that's the other thing. There's a lot of greenwashing where you're kind of sold products and things with a leaf on the label, you know, as if this is going to solve all your problems. And then when you read, you're like, hang on, this isn't actually eco anything. You read the ingredients and you're like, that's a load of chemicals. It's not, you know, what you're claiming it is. You know, so I think there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of negative information. And it's about us individually choosing what you read and when you read it, and maybe making a personal choice not to always get sucked into it, and to do what you can, I think, is the big thing that I'm trying to come to, is to do what I can and try not to stress about what I can't do. And if I have a choice between two things like disposable nappies or cloth nappies, I'll try the cloth nappies and I'll give it a good go. And if I can't do it for whatever reason, I'll try not to beat myself up about it. And I wonder, is that another thing? Are people shaming each other about things? Like maybe the cloth nappy brigade are shaming the non-cloth nappy people. And I think we can't do that either. You know, you have to be each to their own, except for the coffee cups. But, you know, it's tough.
I know. It's just a really different way to live. And I do often think about my mum's generation and how ignorance must have been bliss. She was just throwing us in the car. She was smoking her cigarettes. We were having spaghetti hoops without her, freaking out about it. We just know too much now.
And that's the information age, isn't it? That there's an information overload in terms of news consumption and information consumption, because we all have phones and the news is on there, social media is on there. You've groups with people sharing articles and tips and you should do this and tell me you're not still doing that. You know, whereas back in the day, you know, people, and I don't know if people in Ireland did this, I knew people in New Zealand did this when I lived there, would just bury their rubbish out the back garden in rural areas where there was no kind of
yeah, or big bonfire thing.
Burn it all, exactly. And you kind of think, surely we have come a long way and we are doing a lot, but there's still the idealists out there who are, I don't know, maybe there's a bit of shame attached to it. And it's recognising that and going, do you know what, I'm not going to let myself go down that road. I'm not going to be shamed. I'm going to do what I can. And maybe even that's just thinking about it at a local level, you know, that you'll bring whatever things you can recycle to a certain place where you know they'll be recycled. Because that whole recycling myth, I haven't figured that out yet either. You know, that they say that, I don't know how much percentage of your stuff isn't being recycled at all. Where is it going?
I know that you have to just stop. And I do remember hearing Ruby Wax be interviewed, and she had mental health issues, so decided to educate herself and studied psychology extensively. And one of her pieces of advice in the interview to people was, don't read the newspapers. Don't listen to the news. You can't help somebody in Syria right at this time. And if you're going to take all of that sadness on, it's going to bring you down. So, I mean, that's not everybody. Obviously, some people need to listen and be informed and, you know, become activists and campaign for people. But she said, if you're of a sensitive persuasion, back out of there. But it seems like with climate change, we have to be involved. We can make a difference.
Yeah, but I guess she's right in a way, you know, in that, for you or me to worry about China's carbon footprint or the level of pollution there, there's not a lot I can do about what China's doing or not doing. I guess I could not buy products made in China. Fair. But it's maybe me and you thinking about it more at a local level. What can I do in my area? You know, there's one campaign which I think is so clever and so simple. When you go to the beach, pick up 3 pieces of rubbish and take them with you. And you're like, that's something I can do at the weekend when I'm going to the beach in Dollymount or Sandymount, wherever, at a local level where I feel like, okay, I am doing something, but I'm not going to stress about what China's doing or what Trump is doing in the US, because I don't have control over that. And it's a good tactic for anxiety at all in most situations. What can I control about the situation? What can I not control? And if you can't control it, try not to worry about it, because if you can't do anything about it, what are you going to do? But I think climate change is a funny one, because people will say, oh, but you can do this and you can do that. Mm. And you shouldn't drive your car and da, 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 and you're just, it's sort of never ending, which I think is maybe where the anxiety comes, that no matter what you do, you feel like you know, like I'm a cloth nappy person, as I've suggested, or as I've mentioned, and now I just bought wipes that are reusable. And it's kind of, okay, I've got those. Now, should I be using sanitary products that are reusable? Should I be using, you know, you start to look at everything. And I think that's where the anxiety comes in. And we all have to decide individually, I'm going to do so much, but I'm going to try not to worry about what I can't do or what I can't control.
Because I watched a video of a group. I might tweet it later on. It's from BBC Northern Ireland, so we can get access to watch it. And it was a psychologist having three of her clients there talking about the anxieties and the worries that they have. Three very intelligent, very learned people. And the girl was getting really upset, and she was saying, you know, I'm not bringing children into the world because there's no future for children. And she was literally making an impact on her whether or not she'd become a mother or not. And I just thought that is just so dark, and I don't really go there in my head.
Well, and people do. You know, Prince Harry said he's only going to have two children because of the impact on the planet, which I don't really buy, because I thought the idea was to have none if you don't want to impact the planet. But yeah, for that kind of thing to be affecting your life decisions about whether to procreate, that to me seems a little too much. But then there's some people that are peddling that and saying that that's the answer. Aren't the three things flying, children, and maybe was it cars?
God, all three of these boxes are ticked in my life. What about children then? Because aside from having them, once you do, they're learning about climate change a lot in school. And I think it's incredible that they are learning about things that we didn't even think about. I think it's good that we're awake to all of these things. But I have heard anecdotally from other parents that they have anxious children, kids who are losing sleep at night because they're worrying about the end of the world. And it's certainly not something you want to impact on your childhood.
No, and I think that's a tough one, because children are obviously innocent and idealistic more than we are by the time we grow up. So I think climate change for them, they can see the realities and they're looking at their parents or adults or government or whoever and being like, why aren't you doing something about this? And they're actually right. They're totally right. Because I think we have kind of cognitive dissonance that we know, yeah, it's bad, but I'll do it anyway. Like smoking, lots of things that we do don't make any sense at all. And children will just be like, but that's dirty. Why would you do that? And you're like, do you know what? You're totally right. And they're obviously very conscientious. And what I would say with children ideally is to obviously work with the anxiety with them, work through thoughts that maybe are too catastrophizing about certain things, deal in facts if you can, which is tough with this one because the facts are dark. But again, bring it back to local level. What can you do in your house that your child is happy to recycle this or reuse that or buy this secondhand or not fly this year, take the ferry to France for your holidays? But to get them involved in those choices and those decisions so they feel like, you know, when we go to the beach or we go to the park, my daughter started picking up rubbish because she sees her dad do it. And I'm like, that's a really positive bit of role modelling that's seeping in from the age of two onwards. You know, that you can get them involved and get them doing things, get involved with local groups, projects, stuff at school, and make them feel like they're doing something. Because I think the hardest part about a lot of this is that we feel like we've no control and we feel like we're hopeless. But in fact, you can do stuff at your own level within your own kind of ability and try and be happy with that rather than feel guilty for what you're not doing. Look at what you are doing.
Yeah, because without hope, you know, what do we have? And I know it sounds very deep on a climate change level, but I mean for your mental health and for finding your way through anxiety, surely hope and positivity is what you need to be focusing on.
And I think there's Mark Pollock is an amazing kind of adventurer who talks about this marriage of hope and acceptance, which I think is a really interesting thing, that it's good to dare to hope for things, but it's also good to accept the reality of things. So to try to marry those two, accept what you can do, hope you can do more, and maybe always work to be improving, but try not to over guilt yourself or over shame yourself for not doing this and that. You know, and the other thing is to try not to judge others, although I'm guilty of it myself when I see someone throw something out, or I'll be going through the rubbish, even in work or at home, and I'll be like, this is recyclable, that's recyclable.
No, so do I, especially in offices. I take lumps of paper out of bins and I say that the recycle bin is just over here. So I am on that buzz, but yet I don't lose sleep over it. I do ultimately think that something is going to come good out of it.
So maybe you've got a healthy approach, that you've got the right balance of being conscientious and conscious of it and doing what you can, but not letting it get to the point where it's affecting your day-to-day life or your ability to sleep. And for the people who are at the other end, I'd suggest maybe some counselling, possibly some work around anxiety. It might just be the kind of people who are deep thinkers anyway, or who are very reflective and have personal responsibility, you know, in terms of the world, community, neighbourhood, all of those things. And it's just about working out, okay, well, what's a healthy level of being goal focused to do something, but not at a point where if you're not sleeping, you know, or the girl who's not having children, not that I would judge that completely, her decision, but she did seem really emotional about the fact that, you know, she wasn't going to live the life she wanted to live because she was worried that the planet wouldn't be here in 20 yeah. years or 30 years.
Because you still only get out this one life, so you may as well cram in as much as you can, especially if we're all doomed. Should you mute people that, you know, spout things that make you feel anxious?
I'd say, yeah, definitely mute people that aren't helpful, or don't look on social media after a certain time at night so that you're not putting negative stuff into your head. You know, you can mute keywords around certain issues or certain topics if you don't want to read those. You know, don't. And I sort of think that's a healthy thing. And I'd encourage that with most clients who are anxious or overworked or overwhelmed or whatever, you know, to read a book or exercise or go for a swim. I love swimming, sea swimming, amazing. You know, things that are more mindful rather than sitting on your phone for an hour. Guilty of it myself, and trying to get better at not just sitting there scrolling through bad news and feeling down about it. And then being like, hang on a second. Why aren't I talking to the people that I'm in a room with? Or why am I going outside for a walk? You know, just get outside, even if it's raining, even if it's not beautifully warm. Just try yeah. and do something for yourself rather than sit and feel bad looking at stuff on the internet.
Well, I'd love to hear from you if you suffer from eco-guilt. Get in touch with the show. Helen Vaughan, psychotherapist with Maynooth Counselling. Thank you very, very much. So that's it from Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy, researcher Elaine Power, and Jojo Cardoza was on sound. Vincent Wall is up next. Have a good week.